The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Migrants continue to pour across the border.
It's very clear why there's a crisis. It's very clear why thousands of individuals are coming to that border.
And the White House struggles to explain it away.
Children presenting at our border.
Senator McConnell addresses the effort to eliminate the filibuster.
Now, under pressure from the outside, many of our Democratic colleagues are abandoning their stated principles as fast as possible.
And China takes verbal shots at the U.S.
They may see weakness in the United States.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. At last, a few pictures emerge from the thousands of migrant children who have crossed the border on the promise that the Biden administration will not deport them. The White House has deliberately kept reporters at arm's length, and those reporters, for the most part, have complied. But a few are asking tough questions. Earlier this week, CNN's Jake Tapper blistered President Biden for breaking the promise he had made during his inauguration to level with the American people. Chad Wolf was once the acting United States Secretary of Homeland Security. He joined Dan Prof and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer out of Chicago.
What about comments we're getting from those migrants making their way to the border? I'm here because Joe Biden and the Biden administration's policies and pronouncements have given me hope that I can get in.
Yeah, this really isn't all that difficult. I think if you just see the messaging, not only the messaging, but the actual policies taken since Inauguration Day, it's very clear why there's a crisis. It's very clear why thousands of individuals are coming to that border. Because they vote with their feet, and all they have to know and hear is that a friend, a relative, or someone else has gotten across into the country and is staying here. And if that's what they hear at the end of the day, they will continue to come. We will continue to have a surge and a crisis until you find a way to stop the illegal activity and hold people accountable. This will continue.
But what about, the mixed messaging, obviously, but you have moms now that are about to give up their kids so that their kids could become American citizens, get into this country, and then they'll go back.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the most dangerous things is the surge of unaccompanied alien children, UACs, at the moment. And what we know is a lot of them don't make this journey on, by themselves. The families sometimes make it with them, and then shortly before the border, they separate themselves, knowing that the child will get in, but perhaps the family member will not. So the policy that the Biden administration has taken, which is allowing all alien children to come in, regardless of whether they have asylum claims or not, is actually a very inhumane policy because it's providing hope and it's sending a signal it's okay to separate your children. We should be delivering the exact opposite message at the end of the day.
How did you respond to the pictures from border facilities, the sort of pictures that the left had a core meltdown over a few years ago and now won't even address, pretend like they don't exist? And of course, DHS Secretary Mayorkas and Jen Psaki are doing their best to stave off the press from access.
Yeah. So my heart breaks for the CBP, the frontline officers on the ground along that southwest border. They're doing the very best that they can. Unfortunately, decisions are being made higher than them at the leadership level, both at the department and at the White House, that are putting CBP officers in untenable situations. They have very few resources to accommodate these folks, but are doing the best that they can. But you're exactly right. If this was 2019 and those pictures out, we had Democratic members of Congress camped out at Border Patrol stations along that southwest border. I think only one or two members of Congress have visited now. So the hypocrisy is very thick these days. The same things that they were outraged in 2009, they are very silent here in 2021. And we know why. It's politics, and it's unfortunate that we are playing politics, not only with border security, but at the end of the day, this is national security, because we know embedded in this flow of individuals are criminals and sometimes known or suspected terrorists as well. So this is much more than just politics. This is about border security and national security.
Well, not to mention, as you well know, those who are infected with COVID who have been released, or those who are in situations like those facilities where you could have some infected with not infected and spread the virus and so forth. And it just runs afoul. I mean, not that this is existential, but it just runs afoul of all of the moral indignation and the hand-wringing about COVID policy you get from this administration, what we see at the border.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. There's no consistent message coming from the administration, particularly on the COVID piece that you just mentioned, but also on the Title 42 piece, which is that public health order that they're turning around single adults. They're not turning around, or I should say, they're only turning around about half of families, and then they're not turning around minors at all under that public health authority. So they're very inconsistent, while at the same time, if you're a Mexican minor, they're turning you around immediately. So they have there's a lot of holes in their approach to this border security crisis. And again, I don't see it getting better anytime soon.
One story within this story is how remarkably different media is handling the Biden administration's effort to keep the press from seeing the conditions where the children are detained, relative, of course, to how President Trump was treated. President Trump didn't have near the numbers we are seeing at the border now, but the media was outraged then. They are barely curious now. Here's Salem host Larry Elder.
Now, do you remember way back in 2019 when the photos of the migrant girl and her dad drowned in the Rio Grande sparked a big wave of attacks against the Trump border policy? And remember when Trump blamed the Democrats for the drowned migrant?
Open borders mean crime, and open borders mean people drowning in the rivers, and it's a very dangerous thing. They have to change the laws. And then that father, who probably was this wonderful guy with his daughter, things like that wouldn't happen.
Oh, my goodness. Kamala Harris said, and I'm quoting her, "These families seeking asylum are often fleeing extreme violence. And what happened when they arrived? Trump says, go back where you came from. This is inhumane. Children are dying. This is a stain on our moral conscience." End of quote. Others piled on. Well, the reason I'm mentioning this is because I'm holding in my baby brown libertarian fingers an article from Newsweek, March 19, year of our Lord, 2021. Headline. Did I mention Newsweek, not Fox? Headline. Did I mention Newsweek, not MSNBC? Huh? Okay. Headline. Did I mention Newsweek, not New York Times? New York Post, rather. Headline, migrants drown in Rio Grande amid surge in crossing at southern border. The U.S. Border Patrol Laredo sector issued a press release, quote, agents witnessed several individuals exit a vehicle and attempt to swim across the Rio Grande River into Mexico. Several individuals were apprehended in the vehicle at the encounter. Some individuals entered the river safely and made it to the Mexican riverbanks. One individual was rescued by a local fisherman and rendered first aid by agents. Two individuals succumbed to the dangerous currents of the Rio Grande River and perished. The incident remains under investigation. End of quote. Kamala Harris, did you check her internet file, Mr. McConnell? What's that? Covered with bear, huh? Now, it's gotten to the point where even CNN is calling what's going on in the border a crisis, a crisis. And it isn't because they're objecting to what Joe Biden is doing. They're perfectly happy with people coming up here. They just want them to not have bad optics. But it's gotten to the point where if you're going to have a sliver of credibility, even among the left-wing viewers, they want their views corroborated, you have to call a spade a spade.
She did. Well, that's notable you called it a crisis. That is something the administration has repeatedly declined to call it. And now not only are they not calling it that, they are specifically saying this is not a crisis. That's what Jen Psaki was telling reporters when she was pressed multiple times on what's happening on the border. And to just get a taste of what she said, here's the briefing earlier today.
Children presenting at our border who are fleeing.
Children presenting at our border. It's like doctors say. Patient elder presented, presenting at the border.
Violence, who are fleeing prosecution, who are fleeing terrible situations, is not a crisis. We feel that it is our responsibility to humanely approach this circumstance and make sure they are treated with treated and put in conditions that are safe. I will say that these photos show what we
CNN.
We've long
and they're showing this excerpt of the White House press secretary, and then they're going to comment.
Been saying, which is that these Border Patrol facilities are not places made for children. They are not places that we want children to be staying for an extended period of time. Our alternative is to send children back on this treacherous journey. That is not, in our view, the right choice to make.
So there you see, she is acknowledging that, yes, they are seeing a record number of people at the border, but she is talking about what they're doing to fix it, their attempts to fix it. Of course, the question is, how long is it going to take? And the other thing, Brianna, is transparency here, because you heard Jen Psaki reference photos. Those are photos that you showed earlier from a lawmaker that we got, because the lawmakers were allowed access to these facilities, but reporters and cameras have not yet. And of course, if you remember right, in 2019, at the height of that crisis, reporters and cameras were allowed into these facilities so we could see firsthand and confirm independently the conditions that these unaccompanied migrant children are being held in. And as you can see from the photos, they're crowded. There are a lot of kids on floors. There are reports of them not being able to shower for several days. And despite the fact that we have been asking for weeks to actually get access to these facilities, it has not happened yet. Though I should note, Jen Psaki told reporters they expect to have an update on that in the coming days. So hopefully it will be access to these facilities so we can see firsthand what it's like and what's happening inside and what the Biden administration says they are trying to rectify.
This is a former cartel trafficker. He's now a legitimate businessman. And he was talking to Jesse Waters. And he said cartel members are disguising themselves among the children to cross the border.
Usually a cartel would have prostitution houses in the border town. You know what we call the red zone. They have the... They smuggle kids, either they put them across or they have them there before they go across. And they, especially little girls that they can use, like 12 years old, and they start teaching them and having them and molding them to their practice, you know, of prostitution. They take young kids and put them on the streets and start teaching them the ways of the street with guns, killings. You know, you can call them hired assassins.
This is a former cartel trafficker.
Coming up, Democrats seek to obliterate the filibuster.
Now, under pressure from the outside, many of our Democratic colleagues are abandoning their stated principles as fast as possible.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The filibuster has been a part of the United States Senate since the 1800s. It grants the minority party a sliver of power. At one time, the minority had the ability to stop votes on appointments that they found troubling. That's gone. But they retain the ability to stop votes on bills. It takes 60 votes to overcome a filibuster on a bill. It's a key piece of what has made the Senate what is oft referred to as a cooling chamber. When the Democrats were in the minority as recently as last year, they applauded the filibuster and they used it often on bills. Now they hold a slim majority and they want the filibuster gone. Senator Mitch McConnell took to the Senate floor this week to chastise these same Democrats.
Mr. President, today I'd like to begin with a few quotations. Quote, the legislative filibuster is the most important distinction between the Senate and the House. Without the 60-vote threshold for legislation, the Senate becomes a majoritarian institution, just like the House, much more subject to the winds of short-term electoral change. No senator would like to see that happen. So let's find a way to further protect the 60-vote rule for legislation. And that was the current Democratic leader, Senator Schumer, in April of 2017, less than 4 years ago. Here's another quote, Mr. President. What about the nuclear option, doing away with the filibuster? I can tell you that would be the end of the Senate as it was originally devised and created, going back to our founding fathers. We have to acknowledge our respect for the minority, and that is what the Senate tries to do in its composition and in its procedure, end quote. That was the assistant Democratic leader, Senator Durbin, in 2018, about 3 years ago. A few years ago, 33 members of the Senate side signed a letter insisting that, quote, we preserve existing rules, practices, and traditions regarding legislation. Now, under pressure from the outside, many of our Democratic colleagues are abandoning their stated principles as fast as possible. Yesterday, Senator Durbin said the filibuster is not a core principle, but, quote, an offhanded clerical suggestion. An offhanded clerical suggestion. And a number of Senate Democrats are trying to pressure the senior senators from West Virginia and Arizona to abandon their own very recent commitments to honor this central rule of the Senate. Now, Mr. President, the framers designed the Senate to require deliberation, to force cooperation, and to ensure that federal laws in our big, diverse country earn broad enough buy-in to receive the lasting consent of the governed. James Madison said the Senate should be a complicated check against improper acts of legislation. Thomas Jefferson said great innovation should not be forced on slender majorities. Senate Democrats parroted all these arguments when they were the ones benefiting from minority protection. When President Trump pressed Republicans to kill the filibuster, our Democrat colleagues cried foul. And when our Republican majority stood on principle and refused to wreck the rules, our Democratic colleagues happily used the filibuster themselves. In some cases, they flat out blocked legislation, like Senator Tim Scott's police reform bill. Does anyone really believe the American people were voting for an entirely new system of government by electing Joe Biden to the White House and a 50-50 Senate? There was no mandate to completely transform America by the American people on November 3rd.
The first meeting between China and the United States during the Biden administration got off to a very rocky start. What was billed as a short photo op in Anchorage turned into a verbal slugfest as Chinese officials called the United States uncooperative and weak. Josh Rogan, political columnist on foreign affairs for the Washington Post, wrote a new insightful book titled Chaos Under Heaven. It details the tense confrontation between Beijing and Washington during the Trump years. He joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Were you surprised by that collision that occurred in Anchorage?
No, I think, in fact, it was inevitable. I think that, you know, the Biden administration, given the reality of our relationship with China and the reality of American politics, had no choice but to go to Anchorage and say the things that they said, which is that the United States could no longer remain silent in the face of an increasing Chinese Communist Party, internal repression and external aggression. And it's not surprising to me at all that the Chinese side is not happy about that. Now, it was surprising to me that they were so public and so bold, so brazen. And we can talk about why that is, but on the one hand, it shows that they may see weakness in the United States and they're testing the Biden administration. On the other hand, they may feel insecurity back at home.
No, I wanted to point out that in Chaos Under Heaven, it's not a Democratic book, not a Republican book. It's an American book because it's about America versus China. And it's the struggle of our life and of our children's lives and our grandchildren's lives. China has become the central dilemma of our time. And the Nixon-Kissinger years, their engagement strategy, repudiated by Nixon himself in 1994 in a conversation with William Safire, and most recently by Mike Pompeo at the Nixon Library, remains kind of a haze and a fog through which Americans walk, Josh Rogan. I gather it is your attempt to clear away that fog that led to Chaos Under Heaven.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, as it turns out, the rise of China is a complex thing, but not something that can be relegated to the discussion of ivory towers or just the China hands that have been mismanaging this relationship, frankly, for the last 40 years. And while I was writing this book, urging Americans to wake up to the challenge of a rising China in our academia, on Wall Street, in Silicon Valley, in Hollywood, something amazing happened. Actually, all of these institutions of American society started to figure it out from themselves, because China's actions outside of its borders all of a sudden started to impact everyone, from the NBA to the airlines to your local student at your local school. So that was a broad awakening that was already happening before the pandemic hit. Once the pandemic hit, then every human in every country realized that what happens in Beijing no longer stays in Beijing.
And Chaos Under Heaven brings it all together, beginning with the most important point of the book. There is a genocide underway with the Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities in Xinjiang, and it began in 2014. It's expanded to genocide as formally declared by then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and endorsed by now Secretary of State Tony Blinken in his confirmation hearing. There is no doubt about it, and everyone has to measure their complicity with it. And you detail it. I've had some people refer to the 380 camps. I've had other guests on who've hinted at it, described it. But you actually lay out the details, Josh Rogan. It may be the first major book that discusses the Uyghur genocide.
Well, yeah, thanks for noting that. I spent a lot of time with Uyghurs who had survived the camps and the family members of Uyghurs who are still in the camps. And that's almost every Uyghur journalist in the United States has family members in the camp. There's a reason for that. It's because the Chinese Communist Party has been targeting anyone with any foreign ties and literally disappearing all of their family members in its broad campaign of atrocities and coercion. Now, you know, what's amazing about the Uyghur story is it sort of puts a lie to this idea that, you know, oh, it's just these hawkish Americans who want to start a Cold War with China, which is what you'll hear not only coming out of the far left in America, but also coming out of the Chinese Communist Party propaganda outlets. And the Uyghur genocide is just the most glaring, awful example of that.
There's much more to my conversation with Josh Rogan. Go to townhallreview.com for the entire interview. Coming up, Amazon deletes a politically incorrect book.
The hardcover is gone, the paperback's gone, the Kindle edition's gone, the Audible book's gone. Even used copies. They won't even allow third parties to sell used copies.
Ryan Anderson when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Ryan Anderson is a prolific young writer who is now heading up EPPC, the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. It was in 2018 that Ryan released When Harry Became Sally. The book received scant attention beyond its targeted market. But just 3 years later, 2021, well, we're living in a vastly different landscape. A few weeks ago, Amazon, the top bookseller in America, pulled the book. Anderson spoke with fellow Salem host Dennis Prager.
What is the thesis of When Harry Became Sally?
In a catchphrase, it's that biology is not bigotry, and that rather than attempting to do what is impossible, you know, transform bodies to align them with misguided thoughts and feelings, we should try to do what is possible, which is to help people embrace reality, including the reality of their own bodies, that it's not loving, it's not compassionate, to put a child on puberty-blocking drugs or cross-sex hormones or to perform a double mastectomy on a teenage girl. And all of that is now happening in our country under the name of civil rights, and that conservatives need to have the courage to speak out against this.
What's happened to your book?
So, you know, it was first published in 2018, and, you know, it sold tens of thousands of copies, and Amazon sold tens of those thousands of copies. And then 3 weeks ago, Amazon disappeared the book. On a Sunday afternoon, someone was trying to buy it, reached out to me to say, hey, I can't find it. And I just assumed it was a technical glitch. I pull out my Amazon app. The hardcover is gone. The paperback's gone. The Kindle edition's gone. The Audible book's gone. Even used copies. They won't even allow third parties to sell used copies. And they're doing this. This took place this Sunday afternoon before a major vote in Congress on a transgender bill that my book is critical of and that I have spoken out against in the past few weeks. And Amazon sells something like 70% of all new adult nonfiction books, 80% of all e-books. This is them using outsized market share to try to shut down debate.
Did you contact Amazon?
We did, because their own content policy says that before they remove a title, they will reach out to publishers and authors to try to explain the decision and try to work something out ahead of time. They never reached out to us. We reached out to them immediately trying to figure out, like, we thought maybe it was a technical glitch. And then they got back to us saying that the book violates their content policy. But they wouldn't tell us, you know, what aspect of the content policy the book violates. They wouldn't tell us what page of the book, you know, commits the violation. They wouldn't tell us why after 3 years of not violating the policy, it only now violates the policy. You know, we all have our suspicions, you know, that Trump was no longer president. You know, Barr was no longer the attorney general. Senator Hawley was no longer a member of the majority party. And so there wouldn't be consequences, they thought, at least at the federal level. And there was a big vote coming up in the House of Representatives. Four senators sent them a letter asking for an actual explanation. And all they will say is that the book violates their policy because, quote, they don't sell books that, quote, frame LGBTQ identities as mental illnesses, end quote. And my book does nothing of the sort, right? And so they've now added libel to the list and defamation to the list of, you know, potential legal problems that they are in for, you know, first delisting the book.
I inferred from your earlier take that you do regard gender dysphoria as an abnormal condition.
Well, I definitely think it's a condition. The analogy that I use in the book is that it's similar to anorexia, right? And so no one would prescribe liposuction to a high school girl with anorexia, but we also wouldn't say that that high school girl is mentally ill, right? It's just, it's not the way that we talk about these issues. So Amazon is intentionally misdescribing the book to make it seem like I take a uncharitable rhetorical approach, you know, make it seem like I'm trying to, you know, denigrate and stigmatize people as their excuse for delisting the book, right? So they're actually, you know, adding insult to injury here by trying to, like, to defame me, to try to harm my professional reputation. Because of what the book does, it talks about this issue in a civil and compassionate way, the way that you would talk about, you know, someone who's struggling with anorexia, right? You wouldn't say that girl's mentally ill, but you would also say she doesn't need liposuction, right? What she needs is counseling. What she needs is help to feel comfortable in her body, and there's not a problem with her body.
Why did they allow Abigail Schreier's book on the subject to remain on Amazon?
I have no idea, because, you know, I think Abigail's book is outstanding. It's excellent. It doesn't pull its punches. You know, I encourage all of our listeners to go out and buy it. You can't buy it from Target, though. You know, Target removed Abigail's book, put it back for a little bit, and I believe just removed it again a couple of weeks ago. And so I don't know. I mean, this would suggest that there's some arbitrariness to Amazon standards. I mean, that, and that's what you were getting at with your question of, you know, are they going to be doing this to anyone who discusses, you know, mental illness? It just seems like they're being arbitrary, they're being selective.
To hear the rest of this conversation, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
By the time we get into the late spring and early summer, we're going to have a lot more people vaccinated.
My conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy.
I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. With the vaccine beginning to impact the United States, the daily numbers on the coronavirus cases and death continue to drop. We have 2 million fewer cases in our country today than at the end of January. Are we out of the woods? By most accounts, not yet, but we are getting close. I spoke this week with Dr. Anthony Fauci, scientist and immunologist who serves as the director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. When will we be, do you think we'll be past a danger point in the virus's ability to go very bad for very many people?
Great question, Hugh. And that's the reason why we often say a global pandemic requires a global response, because even if we, and I believe we will, within a quite a reasonable period of time, suppress the virus in this country and in places in the developed world, the European Union, Canada, Australia, et cetera, where there's the resources to vaccinate essentially the entire population, then you could get good suppression and feel comfortable. However, as long as there's virus replicating in a robust way anywhere in the world, there's always the danger that mutants and variants will evolve and ultimately get back to whatever country successfully suppressed it. So that's the reason why you're hearing a lot about a global effort to suppress this, because we've got to suppress it throughout the entire world. Because if you're doing fine in this country, and then there are regions of the world where there's outbreaks, the virus is going to continue to mutate. And ultimately, because of the extraordinary extensive travel we have throughout the world, it's ultimately going to get back to the countries that suppressed it. So that's the reason why we should have a commitment, and we do, through a number of mechanisms, including COVAX, to make sure that virtually all the countries in the world will have the capability of suppressing it.
So, Dr. Fauci, what happened in 1918 when it eventually went away, even though we didn't have the vaccine? We never got a vaccine for 1918, but it eventually faded away, even though it circulated around the world. What happened there that we can't rely on happening here?
Well, the only trouble with that, Hugh, is that it killed between 50 and 100 million people worldwide in a population that was one third the size of the global population now, which means that would be equivalent to killing between 150 and 300 million people. So when you just ravage the world like that, after a while, you run out of susceptible host, you get herd immunity, and that's it. We don't want to go there. We want to stop it before it does that kind of devastation, which is the reason why the answer is the proper implementation of vaccines.
So, doctor, is it still a possibility that such a ravaging could occur? I believe it is, but I'm not a scientist. I just talked to my official toxicologist, who's a relative, who says, you can't rule it out. I don't know if it's 5 or 10%, but you can't rule it out. Can you rule it out?
You know, you never could rule those things out, but the likelihood of that happening is extraordinarily low, given the fact that we have multiple highly efficacious vaccines. So, I mean, right now, for example, you know, we've vaccinated completely about 14% of the population, and even maybe 24% have at least one dose. By the time we get into the late spring and early summer, we're going to have a lot more people vaccinated. So I think the likelihood of the scenario that you're pointing out, Hugh, is going to be extremely unlikely.
Is there any evidence that it's become, any of the variants that we know of yet, have become more dangerous for children than the original or the variants?
You know, there is a suggestion that one of them is easily infecting children, which means, you know, children still, on the whole, do much, much better than adults. If you look at the rate of hospitalization per 100,000 people, and you look at those charts, children are way, way off on the side of the chart where there's very little hospitalization. But some of the variants, if they have the capability of infecting children more readily, you're ultimately going to see more serious disease in children.
Now, doctor, I asked a few of my friends. I said, Dr. Fauci's coming back. What are your best questions? Great question from a friend who had been part of the thousands of Americans who stepped forward for the trials, did the Moderna trial, got successfully vaccinated. He is wondering, when does he have to get revaccinated? When does the trial people were first in line, they're 6 months into it. Do you have any idea yet when they've got to get a booster shot?
You know, no, we don't. And that's the reason why we observe people for up to 2 years or even longer following vaccination. Right now, we know things look good at least up to 6 months and likely much longer. But the only way you know is you've got to follow people and find out when that level of antibody falls below a certain level and people start getting infected again. So that's one of the things you only learn by observation, Hugh.
Emily Oster, an economist at Brown, wrote a piece in The Atlantic last week, which you probably read, Dr. Fauci, you read everything. The science on transmission by the vaccinated is still hazy. I received my second dose on Saturday. Can I transmit the virus?
Well, you know, whoever asked that question is it's a good question. Right now, we haven't ruled out completely that even though you are, and I'm like you, Hugh, I'm vaccinated also, about whether or not if we get exposed, we could get infected and have no symptoms because we're vaccinated. And if there's enough virus in our nasopharynx, theoretically, we could infect someone else, which is the reason why we ask people to continue to wear masks. Having said that, as the weeks and months go by, more and more papers are coming out saying that the likelihood of transmitting from a vaccinated person gets lower and lower because some studies are looking at the level of virus in the nasopharynx, and it's either absent or very, very low. I would predict, though you just got to be careful with predictions, that after several more months, Hugh, we're going to get enough data to say that the likelihood of transmitting an infection from an asymptomatic vaccinated person is extremely low.
Okay, I'm wrapping up, doctor, because I don't want to take too much of your time. Sunk costs are an economic term. They are very hard for people to deal with. If you're studying the data, have you led to any conclusion on lockdowns? Because we have some states like California that went in hard for lockdowns. They're not doing any better. Indeed, they might be doing worse than Florida, which did not go in for lockdowns at all. So the sunk costs on lockdown are enormous and prevent people from dealing with it objectively. But you understand sunk costs. Did we make mistakes on lockdowns?
You know, Hugh, I don't think so. I think the lockdown situation is really very complicated because there have been some states that said they locked down. And when you look at the actual, you know, tracking them on GPSs about how much they locked down, it isn't nearly as much as was claimed.
For my entire conversation with Dr. Fauci, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, the media's extraordinary take on mass shootings.
France had more casualties from mass public shootings in 1 year, 2015, than the United States had during the entire 8 years of the Obama presidency.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, they'll look at the crisis on our southern border.
They're coming because they think they've been invited.
And an ominous piece of legislation, the For the People Act.
What this act would do would move the management of elections away from states and, in fact, move it into Washington.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell gives a warning on what it would mean if Democrats eliminate the filibuster rule.
Nobody can even begin to imagine what a completely scorched earth Senate would look like.
And cohabitation, marriage, and today's Christian.
Never underestimate the ability of people to look reality in the face and deny it.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. In back-to-back weeks, we had terrible mass killings in the United States. One in Atlanta, Georgia, and another in Boulder, Colorado. It's clear in both instances there were psychological issues at play in the cracked minds of the killers. But Democrats led by President Joe Biden are quickly working to use these tragedies to enact more gun restrictions. John Lott, author of the book The War on Guns, joined Salem host Larry Elder.
As far as mass shootings, John Lott, are concerned, nationwide, where do we rank? Where does America rank?
Oh,
I mean,
I said
nationwide. I meant worldwide.
Sure. So if you do it on a per capita basis, the United States has about 4.6% of the world population, and we make up a little bit less than 1% of the shooters. You know, you look at countries like France, for example. France had more casualties from mass public shootings in 1 year, 2015, than the United States had during the entire 8 years of the Obama presidency, even with things like Sandy Hook in there. You look at a country like Russia. Russia has about 50% more mass public shootings than we have here in the United States. They just don't get news attention. I mean, you have something like the New Zealand attack at the mosque, which will get a huge amount of media attention, and I think in part because it fit certain templates that people wanted it to fit.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, few people would know that within 24 hours of that attack, you had a school shooting, a mass public school shooting in Brazil, or you had a mass public shooting in the Netherlands. You know, even if these attacks in European countries, for example, get news coverage, they're very frequently at the back of the newspapers, and there'll just be one story that will mention it. And it just doesn't fit in people's memory.
Kamala Harris's niece, before she deleted her tweet, quote, "The Atlanta shooting was not even a week ago. Violent white men are the greatest terrorist threat to our country," end of quote. Is there a distinction, John, between violent white men and violent white men who are terrorists? What are they talking about?
You know, if you look at white males who are not Middle Eastern descent,
mm-hmm.
they make about 57% of the mass public shooters, but they make up about 65% of the overall population. Are they the majority? Yeah, but they're less than proportion to their population. You know, you look at something like Middle Eastern people, they make up about 8% of the mass public shooters, but they only make up about a half of 1% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
You see Asians are slightly more than their share of the population. Hispanics are much less than their share of the population. Blacks and American Indians are a little bit more than their share of the population.
Mm-hmm.
But the one that's really disproportionate are people of Middle Eastern descent. You look at other types of dimensions, religion, for example. Muslims make up about 10% of the mass public shooters, and they make up about 0.8% of the population.
Thanks for joining us on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producer Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.